In today's video, we're diving down the rabbit hole of history, accompanied by Professor David Atkinson from Purdue University, America.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to speak to you. Thanks.
Professor Atkinson will help guide us in understanding the immigration restrictions and white settler colonies from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century. We'll tackle a number of questions, such as how did these immigration restrictions come about, and what factors drove their evolution. We'll also look at the impact of racialized and gendered stereotypes used to justify immigration restrictions. We'll also look at the implications of these restrictions on international relations, as well as their influence on the identity and self-perception of the migrant groups. As we traverse through our discussion, we'll further dig into the resistance from Asian migrants and their allies, and how this defiance contributed to the erosion of these restrictions. We'll also address how the horrors of Nazi racism affected attitudes towards these policies, and the way fears and anxieties of white settlers transcended beyond immigration laws, materializing in other forms. Moreover, we'll delve into the lasting impact of these historical laws on contemporary immigration policies and perspectives, as well as a whole lot more. Otherwise than that, let's get straight into it. So if you don't mind, could you just give us kind of an introduction of who you are and kind of how you ended up studying this area?
Yeah, so I'm even though we're in different time zones at the moment, I'm originally from the UK. So I'm originally from Leeds, grew up in Leeds, so I'm a big Leeds fan, so apologies to everybody who's not.
Yeah.
I did my undergrad joint degree eventually at Manchester University and studied American studies. And as part of that degree, we get to go over to the United States for a year. So I went to Washington, D.C. in the 90s, and I met an American woman, and we got married. And so I came over, and my wife and I both started PhDs in Boston back in 2000, and I've been here ever since. So I did my PhD in history, actually in American foreign relations history. But increasingly, I became interested in the connection between diplomacy and immigration, which was not something we heard a lot about, 15, 20 years ago. They tend to be discrete topics, tended to be treated as separate topics, because immigration is such a domestic issue that foreign countries cannot have a say in, or at least that's how governments treat it. But in reality, that's not true. Obviously, when you're dealing with people moving across borders, there is an international, transnational diplomatic issue at stake. And so I began to get interested in that and eventually wrote a book on the restriction of South Asian and East Asian immigrants in the British Empire and the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century. So that's how I came to the topic, and that's how I came to be included in this volume.
So before we kind of get into the nitty-gritty of it, could you just perhaps give us an overview of kind of the where, when, and how these restrictions kind of come about, and perhaps just a couple of examples of almost their origins?
Yeah, it's these are restrictions that are typically taking place in what we call settler societies, right? So societies that were settled often by white colonial subjects in the early 19th century through the 19th century. So I'm talking here mostly about the Western Hemisphere. I'm talking about the United States. I'm talking about Canada. I'm talking about South America in particular, and parts of the Caribbean. And I'm also talking about Australasia, New Zealand, Australia, and South Africa on the African continent. So in all of these places, what you start to see is whites settle them and begin to create new governments that are designed in the image of the places they've come from, mostly Britain in this case, or Spain in the South American case, and Germany. They start to create governments they want to be in the image of where they've come, but they also need labor. There's not enough people, and there's not enough people to generate the kind of industrial and productive economy they want to see created in these places. And so they're forced to look elsewhere for labor because there simply aren't enough white settlers to go around all these places. And so that's when you start to see encouragement, actually, of Asian immigration. You start to see what we call coolie immigration, people that are indentured, that are held to long-term contracts from South Asia in particular, but also China, that are brought to these places to conduct specific tasks, to work in specific places under very tightly restricted terms. And then they're expected to be sent back once they've achieved what they're going to achieve. In some cases, you see free migration. You see that in the gold mines of the Western United States and California and British Columbia in Canada and in Australia and New Zealand. And everybody's coming to these places from all around the world. And you see a lot of Chinese come on that basis. But as soon as those gold mines start to peter out, that's when you start to see the restrictions come into play, because they're fighting over less and less, and they're fighting over other areas of the economy. And so by the mid-1850s, 1860s, 1870s, you start to see a backlash against non-white immigration and Chinese immigration in particular in these places. And what happens after Chinese are excluded in a lot of these places by 1870, 1880, is they have to look elsewhere for immigrants. And so they look to South Asia and Japan to fill that void that has been created by Chinese exclusion. Just as in the same way the people turn against the Chinese, people start to turn against South Asians and Japanese. And so these restrictions build and build and build in ways that are designed to keep folks out, so that they're not going to be competitors for the broadening economy that they've helped create in most cases.
I have so many questions just off the back of that. You mentioned how kind of the Chinese are included as labor, and then they're one of the first groups to be excluded, and then South Asians are used as labor and Japanese, and then very slowly they're excluded. What is driving that cycle? Like, what is the mechanism, or kind of what's happening for people to be like, okay, we need all this labor. Oh God, we don't want all of these people. But it almost seems to just be like, oh, let's pick another group. Oh, they don't meet our criteria, so to speak. And so they move on to the next. But like, what is in reality driving that?
It's just a fundamental contradiction, right? Which I think you're picking up on. It's this paradox. It's this paradox between wanting to create brand new societies out of whole cloth, but not having the manpower to do it, not having the labor to do it. And so while these folks want to create societies that are majority white, if not totally white, certainly white supremacist, but they can't do that without the help of people from elsewhere. And so there's this constant tension between try to keep that balance in play, right? We'll use you for your labor. We will exhaust your what we need from you, but then you've got to go back. And of course, many of these people don't want to go back, didn't expect to go back, are making more money than they would have made where they came from. And so then this becomes a kind of an escalating tension in all of these societies. And what's fundamentally at stake, I think, here is capitalism and imperialism, right? Both of these things that are absolutely key processes in the 19th century really encourage mobility. They encourage movement. They want growth, and they want expansion. They want labor. And so you've got these two things that are putting white people all around the world and trying to build these new societies. But at the same time, these people harbor white supremacist views that don't mesh with the needs of capitalism and imperialism. So it's constant tension. It's a constant paradox, I think. These were very contradictory processes in a lot of ways, internally so.
Yeah, no, definitely. You briefly spoke earlier about kind of indentured labor, and like I briefly am aware that there's also kind of guest work programs that are happening kind of almost for a particular period at the same time. Like, before we get into the restrictions of immigration, what are actually the methods of immigration? So besides being an indentured laborer, which is almost to some degree just another form of slavery, and then guest worker, which has a little bit more kind of freedom, although not much, like what other avenues of immigration are actually available, and kind of are they all state-run or enterprise-run?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yes and no. In some countries, you know, like the United States, for instance, it's illegal for contract labor to be used. But the thing about migrants, as I'm sure you and all your listeners know, is they're remarkably resourceful and entrepreneurial folks, and they'll find a way. right? And so even outside of the kind of formal, very structured strictures of indenture or contract labor as it is used in other places like Cuba and Mexico and elsewhere, people are moving on their own, or are there, they're doing what we have all done, I think, as migrants over the years, which is they're following their relatives, they're following their friends, they're joining communities that people from their community have established. It's remarkable in some of these cases where you see, especially in the Chinese case, it's people from one particular area of China that are even allowed to migrate, you know, before the gold rush and around the gold rush. And so most of the folks that come to California are from the same part of China. And so that helps create these networks that migrants engage in. And then you get brokers often from these countries themselves. So there are a lot of Chinese and Japanese folks operating who've made a little money and made a little capital, who are helping to front money for folks to come over. And they're they're creating a network of hotels and people that can help set them up, and they'll owe them money and they'll have to pay back, you know. But yeah, there are all kinds of ways in which people can do this. We might talk a little bit later about some of the loopholes of restriction and being a student, being a merchant, being a diplomat. These are all ways in which you can enter these networks and conduits of mobility.
And are those, like, just the off the back of what you mentioned, those kind of three areas, are they a loophole because there's some level of either expertise or power involved? As in, like, being a diplomat, there's obviously some level of control of what's happening. Although I don't know to what degree, considering it's still a quite imperial system, and there's obviously going to be issues with that. But are those loopholes only available to kind of those who fall, either because they're highly skilled or because they have some position of power, are able to access? Or are there loopholes which kind of the run-of-the-mill person would be able to take, like, advantage of?
Yeah, again, you're right on the money here. They're designed to encourage certain kinds of people. They're designed to create a kind of a hierarchy. But in reality, ordinary people take advantage of these, and they work around these, and they lie, and they cheat, and they trick, because of course they do. They're human beings, right? So you get a lot of folks, you know what? So in 1882, in case you listeners don't know, in 1882, the United States creates something called the the Chinese Exclusion Act. And it is the first racially oriented restriction, or the first major racially oriented restriction ever imposed by the United States on a particular group of people. And this is to kind of limit all of the what they perceive to be low-skilled Chinese laborers who come to the gold fields, come to the railroads after the gold fields, and then establish themselves as communities and working in market gardening, laundries, and creating Chinatowns, etc. That's capped in 1882. And if you're an ordinary Chinese laborer, you cannot come to the United States anymore. But the Chinese government is able to negotiate within that certain classifications that are allowed. So as you talked about, diplomats, students, merchants. So what you see after 1882 is all kinds of folks, basically, you know, a lot of, you know, legitimate students, merchants, and diplomats come. But by the same token, a lot of, you know, not legitimate students, merchants, and folks come. So you see something called, for instance, the paper son system, where Chinese who are in the United States will claim that they have a relative son in China who's going to come over and live with them and study, when in fact these are just sons on paper, which is why they call them paper sons. It's an invention. It's a trick to get around the system. You'll see people, again, masquerading as merchants when in actual fact they have every intention of joining the community here and work. So they do what migrants have always done, you know, they find ways around these things.
No, definitely. It's really interesting because my grandma had to, my family come from, obviously from Punjab, but they're what in some academic fields are called twice migrated, because they went from Punjab to the east of Africa. And then ended up coming to England in the 70s. And again, when you're saying about kind of the loopholes, it just reminds me of the fact that my grandma and my father and his brothers essentially entered this country as illegal immigrants in the 70s because Idi Amin had tried to kick everyone out of Uganda, and the troubles were kind of getting worse and closer and closer. And my grandfather actually just disappeared one day and reappeared in London, rang my grandma and said, just pick up, basically get the boys and kind of get out. We were lucky in that, well, when I say lucky, in that my grandma's brother-in-law was already in London, and he happened to own a travel agent. And so what he did is he booked them tickets, one-way tickets from Kenya to London, and then got their citizenship sorted once they were in the country. So when you was talking about loopholes, I was just like, yeah, I remember my grandma relaying that. And it's true, like, as in, they're resourceful, and they always, and by nature, I think, like, they have to be. So it's interesting how things to some degree haven't changed in a lot of ways.
I mean, what you said is so amazing. What an amazing story. And yet it's so ordinary for so many people in so many of these communities, right?
Definitely.
But not, again, not to diminish how amazing it is, but it's what people have always done. It's what
people do. And I think what is interesting is when you start to realize how close it is, as in, because a lot of times you read it in a book and you think, oh yeah, but then actually when you start to ask your own family or friends perhaps, like, you realize that those stories are ours almost, like, they're literally everywhere. Just then, kind of moving towards some of the restrictions then, like, how is kind of gendered or racialized stereotypes used in order to curb restriction? And I guess, in some ways, how is that used time and time again? Because it goes from excluding the Chinese to excluding the South Asians. And, like, what is going on?
A great question. I mean, this is something I'm really interested in. One of the key ideas in my work are that you have to look at individual places to understand the true genesis and development of particular kinds of ideas and policies. But what I think is universal in the Anglo-American settler world is this kind of ideological ideas about race and racism. And that travels very easily, and that travels very well. There's a really good book by two Australian historians, Marilyn Lake and Henry Reynolds, called Drawing the Global Color Line, that folks might like to look at. And it shows the ways in which these ideas traveled around the Anglo-American settler world. And so you have kind of general ideas that are circulating in these places, that Asian migrants in particular are, and one thing I'll just say right off the bat is, again, these are often profoundly contradictory ideas, right? The thing about race and racism is it's made up, right? Edited. It's not real. And so because of that, it's full of contradictions and paradoxes that they didn't bother to try and reconcile, so neither should we, right? But we should be attentive to them. And so you have situations where, on one hand, you know, Chinese immigrants or South Asian immigrants or Japanese immigrants are perceived to be wildly productive and extraordinarily hardworking and so almost superhuman in their ability to generate wealth that is going to drive the white man under, right? So that exists. But on the other hand, it also exists at the same time that these people are lazy and they would rather not work or do it, and they're just going to leech off the state. They're smoking opium all day and they're languishing in hovels, you know. So these two things are circulating at the same time, and they're mutually contradictory. But it depends on the circumstance which trope you want to deploy, right?
So it's literally like, as in, the tropes are literally just being used as the means to an end. Like, as in, it doesn't matter which trope is being used, they just need something in order to drive their, although there's no logical sense to their ideology, it's still just driven by that white supremacist ideology.
That's what's at the core of it all, right?
Yeah.
It's white supremacy. These are white men's countries. That's what they call them. And these are new nations, new states that are designed to be white people owned. And so anything we need to invent to justify your exclusion, we're going to invent. And that's that cannot make sense, or it can make sense. And again, it depends where you are, right? So if you're in Australia or New Zealand, it's much more prevalent there to see anxieties and apprehensions about distance and proximity. So, you know, Australians, white Australians are really far away from Britain, and therefore they're really far away from the Royal Navy. But they're much closer to China and they're much closer to Japan. So you have an anxiety about distance from the metropole, from the center, from the core, but you also have apprehensions about proximity to this, what they used to talk about as this kind of teeming mass of humanity that all wanted to just escape Asia and come to these white men's countries because they coveted the vast open spaces of Australia or whatever it is, right? That's not as big a deal in California, although certainly proximity across the Pacific is. But there's less apprehension about being far away from white settlement. So it depends where you are and who you are and when you are as to how this particular blend of stereotypes and ideas comes to the fore. But they're all rooted in white supremacy.
Yeah. I guess that's the root. And then all of these colonies are always branches that come off of that. Just in kind of turning to the impact of these policies, like what result did they have in the countries that imposed them? And also what influence did they have then on the countries where these migrants may have been coming from? So for argument's sake, like briefly, you spoke about China earlier being excluded, but then they're able to negotiate. Actually, there are some people who are allowed, students, diplomats, etc. Like, what impacts, I guess, do these policies have on the countries that deploy them? And then how, I guess, are the countries that are impacted managing to negotiate around them?
Well, this was the subject of my last book, shameless plug time, called The Burden of White Supremacy, Containing Asian Labor Migration in the British Empire. And what I'm really focused on in that book is exactly what you've just asked, right? What happens when you restrict people from these places? What happens on a diplomatic level in particular? And so, you know, I mentioned that the Chinese are able to negotiate some loophole, but by and large, it's for Chinese exclusion is very effective because China doesn't have the kind of leverage it needs to get any more concessions. What you see, for instance, in Japan is a very, very different story because Japan is a country that is on the ascent. It is a developing nation that is becoming quite regionally powerful, whereas China is a country that's in decline. So Japan, you don't see a Japanese Exclusion Act almost anywhere around the world because Japan won't accept racial exclusion. They're vigorously opposed to the idea that they're second-class citizens in a global system that they're trying to enter. And they certainly don't want to be conceived as Chinese. They don't want to be seen on the same level as China. They are racially superior. So Japan puts a lot of effort into negotiating exclusion. So what you'll get in many cases is something like a literacy test, for instance. So in the British Empire, that's what they tend to use. Australia has a law after 1901 where basically when you come to the country, the immigration officer will test your literacy, will test your ability to speak a certain language. And it can be, you know, any European language, right? Because too many people speak English. So if you're a Japanese immigrant and you come to Sydney and the immigration officer tests your English language skills and you pass, then he might check your language skills in Welsh, for instance, because I bet you can't speak Welsh, right? Now, that person is not being excluded on the basis of race. They're being excluded on the basis of literacy and education, right? And Japan kind of tacitly accepts that because that's not racial exclusion. That way, they're not being lumped in with the Chinese, right? In the US case and in the Canadian case, the governments negotiate what they call a gentleman's agreement, where Japan agrees not to issue passports so that people can't even leave Japan to come to the United States. And that way, Japanese prestige is not diminished because they're not coming and then being told you can't come in because you're Japanese. The Japanese are actually excluding themselves from migrating, right? Which limits some of the tension. So there are, in all of these ways, country, there's a lot of negotiations going on.
What happens then in the case of, for argument's sake, excluding the South Asians? Because I can't remember the exact year, but I know it's the early 1900s. Canada essentially bars South Asians. And at that point, most of South Asia is under British control. So there is no, like, there isn't the diplomatic kind of scene, say, as Japan might have, or China perhaps, although parts of it, I'm sure, are still under British control at this point. However, my point being is how do, like, what happens at that point? Like, are there spokespeople on the South Asian side who try to negotiate? Like, as in, I guess what I'm trying to ask is when that, when the scenario isn't like Japan and the US, and it's more so perhaps the South Asians, especially under the British Empire, what happens on the diplomatic scene as a result of that?
That's a great question. And what, this is one of the most contentious issues in the 19th century British Empire. It is, it's again, the subject of the last book. Not only do you have diplomatic tensions, but you have intra-imperial tensions because of what you've just described. You know, the Raj is the crown jewel of the British Empire. It doesn't do, from an imperial point of view, to alienate and upset and rouse the people of India against you, right? But the other crown jewels of the empire, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, vehemently white supremacist. And so, again, we've got that tension within the empire. And so the British government is constantly trying to stop white leaders around the British dominions from doing these kinds of things. And so that literacy test in Australia is actually based on a literacy test that was created for the South African colony of Natal, because a lot of South Asians are in Natal working in the sugar fields, etc. And the new South African regime wants to exclude them. And the British government says, well, you can't just say no Indians, right? That's going to cause tension in the empire. So why don't you do something else? A literacy test, which in itself is borrowed from the U.S. South, where they're using literacy tests to prevent African Americans from voting. Right, again, because you don't want to just outright racially exclude people. So they, again, it's a kind of a circulation of ideas. So yeah, the British put enormous pressure on Canada in that case to prevent them from using racially explicit restriction. And Canada comes up with one of my favorite ruses, if one can have a favorite racist ruse, and that is the continuous passage provision, right? Where they say, you know, you've got to come directly from the place you're from in order to immigrate to Canada, knowing there is no direct steamship route from Canada. Yeah.
But then just focusing kind of on how these restrictions get eroded over time, like what takes place for them to change their mind? Like I know in the case of the South Asians, you're saying the British Empire does put a little bit of pressure on to ensure that they're not using explicitly racist language. And to be fair, when they do get back to Calcutta, a number of them are just beaten by the British police that are stationed there. So
you're talking about the Kolmogatta Maru.
Yeah.
Horrific story. Absolutely.
Oh, it's horrible. And it's also interesting to see how that has become almost like a pivotal part of Canadian national identity. But that in itself, I guess, is a whole nother topic. But just focusing on these exclusions, how are they eroded, and like what happens? Is it kind of, I don't know, protest by South Asians that are already in the US or in Canada, or is it pressure by people back home? Like, how do these exclusions get removed? My assumption would be that the countries imposing them for some economic reason probably reduces them or takes them away at points they need extra labor. That's just off the back of the fact that Second World War, England's like, yeah, everyone come on in, and then very quickly shuts the doors once there's too many brown faces. What's going on in this case?
It's so many different things, and you've iterated a couple of them there. Yeah, it's a real amalgamation of factors, I think, that brings these to a close. And they come to a close, you know, post Second World War. So from 1945 to about 1975, we start to see all of these laws go away. On one hand, it's the war just, and Nazism in particular, right? I mean, in many ways, the Nazi project in Europe is the absolute epitome. It's the pinnacle of this white supremacist vision that all of these Anglo settler places have been engaged in, and we've seen where that leads in 1945, and it's horrific. And so it becomes harder to maintain ideologically in the aftermath of Nazism these kind of outright white supremacist ideas. So that certainly is part of it. Then we go into the Cold War, of course, and all of a sudden, countries, the United States in particular, but its allies also, are keen to encourage new allies from the world as it decolonizes in Africa and Asia, right? So in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you start to see the empires break up around Asia and Africa, and the Soviet Union and the United States then vie for allies among these people. Well, it's a really hard case to make if you're the United States and you say, oh, we need China on our side, but don't come here. Right, that becomes a very untenable situation. So Cold War imperatives start to play into this. You want allies, and you can't alienate your allies. But I think, you know, really importantly, it's the migrants themselves, it's the communities themselves, it's people themselves that put pressure on these governments to yield. Again, another plug for a colleague's book. Jane Hong has written a great book called Opening the Gates to Asia. And her book is all about this. It's all about how after the Second World War, all these communities, whether they're South Asian, Chinese, Japanese, Filipino, she kind of has chapters on each community in the United States. And the efforts they make as activists, both in the United States and abroad, to try and bring down these systems. So that's really key as well. Agitation from activists within these communities.
No, thank you. I think the Nazi point is really interesting, because in a lot of ways, like, I remember, you said that you're from Britain, so I'm sure you had to study history right at school. And like, when I did it, you just have to learn the Second World War and like Tudors or whatever. And I remember having to learn about how, and it's something that stuck with me ever since, which is like the early Nazi party sent some of their members to the American South to learn about how the racial laws work there for them to then be kind of imported back into Germany. And just those connections are so startlingly obvious once you connect those dots, but I think you never really thought about it like that. And it's interesting to see how those horrors, and also the fact that there was such a contribution in the Second World War by all these colored folk, like it was almost insurmountable. There's no way England could hold face by saying, yeah, we defeated the Nazis. It's kind of like, well, yeah, you alongside with every single possible member of the empire pretty much spill their blood. Just then kind of looking at these policies as the result of fear, like essentially white settlers are scared about other people turning up on these new colonial projects. How else do these fear and anxieties kind of materialize besides these immigration exclusion acts? Like, what else is going on, like, in order to paint kind of a broader picture around what's happening?
You know, well, one thing I'll say is, well, something I like to say always is, you again hit the nail on the head there, that white supremacists and white supremacism is an extraordinarily fearful and fragile thing, right? I think those who believe in this project like to project it as a kind of de facto truth that cannot be assailed, and it's great power and strength, right? It's not. It's terror and fear and anxiety and fragility that leads to these kind of things, because so often as you read these sources throughout history, it's the very notion that I should live as a white man near a non-white person just diminishes me so thoroughly that I cannot possibly condone it, right? That is a profoundly weak and fearful notion, right? My whiteness and my manhood and my masculinity and being is so threatened by, you know. So again, I appreciate you putting it in those terms. You know, it's because of broader projects, I think, that are unfolding during this late 19th century, early 20th century period. So what's happening, and again, I'm going to plug another colleague's book here. There's a great book called Culling the Masses by David Cook Martin and David Fitzgerald. And what they do is they look at similar places I do, especially in Latin America. And they ask a very simple but obvious question, which is, why is it that democracies in particular have proven so keen to impose immigration restrictions? It does tend to be that these democracies, which are free and open and liberal, are the ones that are creating some of the most restrictive immigration laws in the world. And their answer to that question in part is, well, during these periods, what they're doing is they're creating very capacious social welfare systems. Right. So in the case of Britain, for instance, a national health service, they're creating a very capacious ideal of citizenship that is going to grant you all kinds of privileges and rights. As you build out that social welfare system and you make it bigger and you build out what it means to be a citizen and what it means to be a rights holder in society, the last thing you want is these greedy, undeserving, selfish immigrants getting access to them. At least that's the ideology, of course. And so I think that's the context in a lot of cases, right? When you get to the 20th century in particular, and when you get to the mid-20th century especially, when these countries are creating very capacious social welfare systems, the onus is on you to keep people out. And I think that's the context. I think that's true of the United States after the Civil War, right? I mean, you know, you've completely thrown over an entire political economy of enslavement in the South, but you've got to find another way to keep people under control, or keep people on the farm, or keep people working in a controlled way. And so they begin to evolve new systems of sharecropping and restriction of the movement of African American people in different ways.
My next question is actually based on kind of how these restrictions have influenced current immigration policies and attitudes. And I think one thing that is leaping out like a sore thumb is obviously the recent tragedy in the Mediterranean with the boat that is essentially, I don't know, there's still like 100 odd people still missing. And reports suggested that the Greek Coast Guard or whatever helped essentially tip it into the sea. There's so much opinion that could be said about that. And there's a lot of emotion obviously involved with that as well. But I guess my question is, how have those policies from then helped to create the world that we're in now, where hundreds of people can literally be, for whatever reason, they are illegally stuck on a ship and the whole world abandons them. And yet on the flip side, you've got five people who have paid £250,000 stuck in a submersible somewhere near the Titanic, and you've got I don't know how many millions of dollars worth of search equipment being used right now. How have we ended up going from that? And I guess it's not really a surprise considering we started off with acts that literally excluded people based on their nationality or color of their skin, or doing these literacy tests, which are a means to an end but still getting to that same end. How has all of that history and everything that you've studied help influence the contemporary world that we live in?
Well, we don't want to be here for another 28 hours, but basically it has, right? As you point out, it has. I think the minute that we create nation states bounded by borders, rooted in notions of sovereignty and controlled in terms of human mobility by the passport, that's when you get the world we live in today, right? Prior to this, the world was a profoundly mobile place. People traveled and moved, traded and created all these kinds of networks. But by the 1850s, 1860s, we begin to see these walls go up around nation states around the world. and we start to see human mobility controlled and restricted by the passport, by these laws. And so that's the world we're living in, right? A world that was created in the mid-19th century. And that's why you have a situation like you have in the Mediterranean. You know, that certain people are allowed and certain people are not to travel. And that's rooted in all kinds of economic and racial lines. You know, the thing that really has concerned me as a historian of this stuff is what I've seen in the past kind of 5 to 10 years in terms of the resurgence of a lot of these white supremacist ideas. So as I've looked around since 2016 in particular, since Brexit in Britain, since the rise of Trump in the United States, the rise of populism around far-right governments around the world, you're seeing a lot of the ideas I've written about come back into the mainstream. And they've been repackaged, they've been laundered, they've been transformed, at least on the outside. So instead of talking about white men's countries or white supremacist ideas very overtly, we're now talking about, you know, white nationalism. We're now talking about the great replacement of white people by non-white immigrants. We're now talking about, you know, white genocide or the great erasure and all of these kind of ideas that are trying to create ideological rationales for exactly what we saw happen in the 19th and early 20th century, but just in a cleaner way or a nicer way or whatever it might be. You know, we've had this gentleman over here, Richard Spencer, who's been at the core of the alt-right, right?
Yeah. He's that guy that got like, I've only seen the Twitter video of him getting like...
Some get punched in the face.
Well,
he's very well-spoken and intelligent, graduate degrees, and he wears a nice tweed suit, and he's done a great deal to launder what are really at their core the same old tired white supremacist ideas that we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes, right? But they've found their way into the mainstream again, and it's very frightening. And what you start to see, I think we're closer now to the discourse on immigration that I wrote about in the 1890s than we are to, you know, than we were in the post-Second World War period. We're back in a very dark place when it comes to the discourse around immigration in these places.
I couldn't disagree. Like, even just, like you mentioned Brexit, I think there was some stat which showed, I'll have to obviously double check before, like, this hits the internet, but I think it was something to show, like, attacks against people of color or kind of racially motivated attacks in the UK went up by some ridiculous percent post-Brexit. And obviously the whole campaign was based on excluding immigrants and excluding migrants. And yeah, it's like, as in, we're all living in it. But what your answer helps with is, like, leads me into the next kind of couple of questions which I wanted to ask you, which is, A, where do you see it going? Like, you said that we're very much closer to what you studied than we aren't, so to speak, and we haven't actually progressed, which is often the assumption when studying history, which is there's some type of like progression or progress that's being made. Where do you think it's going to go? And in an ideal world, where would you like it to go? So if you could almost take control of what you're studying, what changes would you make in order to make it better or to work? Or would you just dismantle the whole thing and say, actually, this whole thing's rooted in something that's so, what's the word? Oh, I can't even think now. It's rooted in something that's so poisonous, actually. There is no way you could. It's almost like the I know this probably showing my age, but you know when there's the old Jason and the Argonauts and he cuts Medusa's head off and all the blood keeps dropping and it's creating all these like snakes. It's almost like that. Like, as in, if you try to dismantle it, surely it itself will find a way of always trying to reemerge. But yeah, where do you think it's going? And in an ideal world, what would you like to see happen?
You know, I don't have a profound or edifying answer to that question. And I'll cheat by saying I'm a historian, so I'm more responsible for the present. Despite spending the last 45 minutes telling you we can understand the present through the past. The human being in me wants what you described, right? just eradicate it all. It is, I agree, it is rotten at its core, and it's difficult to imagine repairing any of these systems. But by the same token, I'm not sure that that's a solution that gets us to where we want to go either. And that's particularly acute now, of course, because of the climate crisis and the fact that we're going to see massive waves of climate refugees and human mobility on a scale I think even the 19th century would struggle to comprehend. So it is absolutely imperative that smarter people than I find a way to repair these systems or reconstruct these systems or just do something differently, because this ain't working. And you know, we've seen efforts, I think, since when these systems were demolished, the racially explicit systems were demolished in the 50s and 60s and 70s. They were replaced by kind of blanket quota systems in the case of the United States, right? So instead of having racially targeted quota systems, which they introduced in the 20s, we have just a blanket quota, and then that seemed to be colorblind or whatever. Or we have point systems in places like Canada, right? Or skills-based immigration systems, where we'll take the best of you, but we won't take the rest of you. But that was far cleverer than I intended it to be, by the way. That was right. That's now copyrighted, by the way, world. And I'm sure someone else has said it, but yeah, none of these things which sound progressive and modern and productive in theory have proven to be so. So I hate to end on a note like that, but it's hard to imagine what the future looks like, because people are desperate and they're getting more desperate, and people have a right to be economically productive and socially and culturally productive, and they have a right to be with their families. We're finding it very difficult as a species to square that circle. I don't know.
And that's a wrap for today's podcast episode, folks. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. As usual, a massive shout out to our YouTube members: Final Ink, German Bauer, Wushu Man, A Little History of the Sikhs, Jugraj, Sanjeev, Vishal Goldar, Raj Sharan, Not Daven, Aman Reed Mandir, Hunter Hilt, Radhaji Kaur, Gurmeet Dunjal, Gary Pramar, N Singh GS, and Jazz Dillon. And as always, let's not forget our amazing Patreon members, including Hernan Pazano, Jazz Dillon, Gurpreet Singh, Gurdeep Bath, Anish Mahan, Ramneet Kaur, Rav Singh, Yasmin Jaswal, Ramneet Kaur, Gagan Singh, Gurpreet Dunjal, and Rajvinder Kaur. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a patron or a paid YouTube member today. You can find the links in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I can't wait to see you all in the next one.